Section 1. Free voters to vote. Make it easier, cheaper, and more secure for all Americans to vote. We'll start our journey toward a better democracy in an obvious place, voting. When most people think of a healthy, representative government, they think of that most concrete and fundamental right allotted to every one of a country's citizens. Voting should be an easy, efficient, inclusive, secure process that makes everyday people feel that their voices matter and makes them want to vote. Unfortunately, this is not the case in the United States, as the following four chapters will discuss. First, it can be hard to get and stay registered to vote. From registering in the first place, chapter one, to dodging the suppressive tactics of voter roll purges and voter ID laws, chapter two. Second, it can be a hassle to vote, with distant polling places, long lines, and expensive, questionably secure voting machines, chapter three. Third, some states have stripped the right to vote from millions of people on the basis of felony convictions, the definition of which varies greatly from state to state. This is frequently the case even after those people have served their sentences, chapter four. These conditions are no accident. Some are the result of policy and legal decisions that have systematically disenfranchised certain groups of people for decades or even centuries, and some are more recent incarnations motivated by partisan politics. Others have resulted from a failure to modernize, despite opportunities to do so, and proof that new programs would serve the public better. Below, we'll briefly discuss three major components of this suppression. States control who votes and how, with widely varying effects on voting rights. Most Americans would consider the right to vote to be fundamental. But at its founding, fewer than 10% of people living in the United States were allowed to vote. The Constitution was silent about who could vote, so states decided for themselves. Mostly, they decided that only white, Protestant, property-owning men could exercise that right. Over time, Americans amended the Constitution to allow men of color to vote, the 15th Amendment in 1870, and eventually to allow women to vote, the 19th Amendment in 1920, and finally to allow people who can't afford to pay to vote, the 24th Amendment in 1964. Today, most Americans assume that everyone has the right to vote. Not so. Though poll taxes and literacy tests are technically no longer part of our election process, some states have found ways to institute policies with much the same effect, and the Supreme Court has let them. These states make it difficult for voters to register or to stay registered, forcing them to jump through hoops only to later purge them from the voter rolls anyway. Or they require voters to show identification that they don't have or might have difficulty obtaining. Or they make it hard to vote, holding elections on a workday and limiting polling places so that long lines at the polls force some Americans to choose between casting their votes and keeping their jobs. Or they take away voting rights from people with felony convictions and never give them back, even when those people have served their time. None of these practices encourages citizens to exercise their democratic right. Rather, these suppressive practices are part of the reason the United States has some of the lowest rates of voter participation among wealthy nations. Disenfranchisement by design, a closer look at racism embedded in voting rights laws. The 14th Amendment, ratified in 1868 after the Civil War, gave formerly enslaved people born or naturalized in the United States the right of citizenship. But the amendment also created a gaping constitutional loophole. Section 2 allowed states to deny people the right to vote for participation in rebellion or other crime. This clause gave states a reliable and expansive qualification by which to strip former enslaved people and their descendants of voting rights. The architects of state criminal disenfranchisement laws were not vague about their purpose. They intended to stop Black Americans from voting. Florida, for instance, which established its state constitution after the Civil War, passed a raft of Black codes that make it easier to convict Black men of felonies and then permanently disenfranchised all felons. Not far away in Virginia, a delegate to the state's 1902 Constitutional Convention addressed reporters. "I told the people of my county before they sent me here that I intended, as far as in me lay, to disenfranchise every Negro that I could disenfranchise under the Constitution of the United States, and as few white people as possible." In a supposed justification for this, he reminded the convention's attendees that in the South, 6 whites out of 10,000 were in prison, compared to 29 Blacks out of 10,000. A result, he doubtless intended to infer, of moral inferiority rather than racist laws. The United States now imprisons many more people, and the racial disparity has only gotten worse. As of 2014, 46 of every 10,000 whites and 272 of every 10,000 Blacks were in prison. Most are serving time for drug offenses. The Virginia Constitution that delegates helped ratify included a clause that disenfranchised any Virginian who committed any of a broad swath of crimes, including treason or any felony, bribery, petite larceny, obtaining money or property under false pretenses, embezzlement, forgery, or perjury. The legacy of that sweeping law? Today, Virginia is one of 3 states whose constitution permanently takes away people's right to vote if they are convicted of a felony. The Constitution does not guarantee the right to vote, and the Supreme Court does not reliably protect voting as a fundamental right. The first 10 amendments to the Constitution are known as the Bill of Rights, and they protect freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom to gather in an assembly, and other rights. But an important right is missing: the right to vote. Several subsequent amendments have given piecemeal voting protections for people of color, women, and people who can't pay poll taxes, but none goes so far as to state that all Americans have a right to vote. But that's okay. The Supreme Court justices can read those amendments, all of which reference the right to vote, and conclude that Americans have the right to vote, correct? Well, maybe. While the Bill of Rights states broadly that its rights shall not be infringed for any reason, the amendments relating to voting all name specific ways that voting rights cannot legally be denied, such as on the basis of race, skin color, or sex, leaving open to interpretation whether states may find other, more creative ways to limit voting rights. Here's another angle. The court has found some rights merely implied in the Constitution to be fundamental rights deserving of the same respect and protection as those explicitly laid out in the Bill of Rights. These include the right to marry, to engage in interstate travel, and, yes, to vote. But unfortunately, the court has been inconsistent on this last item, sometimes declaring boldly that the right to vote is indeed fundamental, but other times treating it as a privilege rather than a right. It's important that the court recognize voting as a fundamental right, because then it will almost certainly strike down any law that infringes on that right or is burdensome to those wishing to exercise it. In some cases, where the court has declared voting to be a fundamental right, it has applied a strict scrutiny test to the burdensome law in question. This means the entity supporting the law, say a certain state legislature or the U.S. Congress, must prove that the law passes 3 tests. The law must be 1, justified by a compelling government interest; 2, narrowly tailored to achieve that compelling interest, and 3, the least restrictive means of achieving the compelling interest. In other words, the defenders of the burdensome law must basically say, we know this law is infringing on an important right, but it has to, and there's no other way. The court then asks, okay, if you have an incredibly important purpose, you might need to infringe on basic rights, but is there any other way for you to accomplish your purpose in a less burdensome manner? Often, the answer is yes, and the law is struck down. The strict scrutiny test has worked to strike down a poll tax and limits on who is eligible to vote. But again, the court applies it only in cases where it recognizes voting to be a fundamental right. In cases where the court has not recognized voting as a fundamental right, it generally has given great deference to governmental entities, applying the more lenient rational basis test. The rational basis test says that as long as a law is rationally related to a legitimate government purpose, the court will uphold the law. The state whose law is in question can usually claim some interest in preventing fraud or ensuring election integrity, and the court then upholds the state's law. This test has worked to uphold a slew of voter suppressive measures over time, including a literacy test for would-be voters, a requirement to enroll in a political party before being allowed to vote, a prohibition on voting for write-in candidates, and a strict voter ID law. The Voting Rights Act is under attack. Congress did try to protect Americans by passing the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and for a while, that federal law made important strides in defending the votes of people of color. But in recent years, a number of Supreme Court decisions have eroded that law's core protections. Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act required states or counties with a history of racial discrimination in their elections to pre-clear with the federal government any changes to their election rules, creating a safeguard against racist restrictions on Americans' right to vote. But in the 2013 decision Shelby County versus Holder, the court effectively disabled Section 4 by ruling that the coverage formula for determining which jurisdictions required pre-clearance was out of date. In essence, the court said, those places may have been racist in the past, but it's 2013 now, and we can't be sure they still are. Congress needs to come up with a new way to identify racist places, and until it does, we will not require pre-clearance by these jurisdictions. So, until Congress can agree on a new coverage formula, and 7 years later it still hasn't, states with a history of racial discrimination are free to restrict voting. And they have. Within 24 hours of the court ruling, Texas announced it would implement a strict photo ID law. Two other states, Mississippi and Alabama, began to enforce photo ID laws that had previously been barred because of the federal pre-clearance requirement. Jurisdictions no longer subject to pre-clearance also began purging more voters from their rolls when Shelby freed them to do so. The Brennan Center for Justice estimates that lifting pre-clearance enabled states to purge an additional 2 million people from American voter rolls between 2012 and 2016. What's more, the 2018 Supreme Court decision, Husted versus Randolph, eviscerated another Voting Rights Act protection that had prevented states from removing eligible voters from their rolls just because they hadn't voted in a recent election. Purges based on missing a vote force voters to needlessly re-register, as Justice Sotomayor pointed out in her dissent, and disproportionately affect people of color, as well as low-income, disabled, and veterans. More on that in Chapter 2. In short, Americans can't count on state laws or the Supreme Court to reliably protect our right to vote. sad, but true. Also true, though, is that there's plenty that regular citizens and our representatives at the state and national levels can do about it. Honor the right to vote. Right now, at this very moment, Americans and their representatives have ready-to-launch solutions that could enfranchise millions more voters and make it easier to participate in that foundational act of democracy, voting. In other words, we can treat Americans as if they have the right to vote without changing the Constitution or relying on the Supreme Court. Automatically register voters. States or Congress can show they want citizens to vote by automatically registering eligible voters through modern and secure registration systems, as Oregon already does, Chapter 1. Use modern standardized technology to clean voter rolls. States can keep their voter rolls clean and updated by joining the 30 states plus DC that already use the Electronic Registration Information Center. Let voters vote conveniently. States or Congress can do away with long lines, confusing or burdensome voter ID requirements, and the costly and hacker-vulnerable infrastructure of dispersed voting sites by implementing Vote at Home, Chapter 3. Preserve or restore voting rights. States can show people with felony convictions that they still matter as citizens and that their crime does not define them, either by allowing them to vote while still in prison, as do Maine, Vermont, and D.C., or by automatically restoring the right once they have served their time. Chapter 4. There are, of course, many more ways that states and Congress can ease burdens on voters, but these four are solutions that many states are already implementing and that many voters are benefiting from. So it's not a question of reinventing the wheel, but just one of pushing it around to more places. Let's get rolling.